are allowed to pocket funds they didn't spend on care. In a statement, PNHB, which has implored the Department of Health and Human Services, HHS, to fully halt the program, outlined how the revamped pilot perpetuates the dangerous flaws of the Trump administration's direct contracting experiment. First, like the DC model, ACO, REACH, will pay middlemen a flat fee to manage seniors' health, allowing them to keep 40% of what they don't spend on care as profit and overhead. Next, traditional Medicare beneficiaries will still be automatically enrolled into ACO-rich entities without their full understanding or consent, and once enrolled cannot opt out of an ACO-rich entity unless they change primary care providers. Like DC's, the ACO REACH program has virtually no limits on what type of company can participate. Entities can be owned by commercial insurers, private equity investors, and other profit-seeking firms, including current direct contracting entities. The new program increases provider governance from 25% to 75% with loopholes built into application process, but ACO REACH entities are ultimately accountable to investors. You can't slap a Band-Aid on a tumor and call it cured, said Rogers. Direct contracting and now ACO REACH threatens the health of beneficiaries and the future of traditional Medicare. As physicians committed to the health of our patients, we urge HHS to abandon this rebranding effort and focus the agency's efforts towards strengthening and protecting traditional Medicare. CMS unveiled its raft of changes to the Medicare experiment just over a week after a coalition of industry groups, including active participants in the direct contracting program, requested that the Biden administration fix the model instead of ending it. The industry organization suggested that a rebranding and name change would help communicate how this model is part of the evolution to accountable care. CMS is headed by Elizabeth Fowler, who has previously worked at WellPoint Incorporation, now known as Anthem, one of the largest private health insurance companies in the United States. While CMS said recently that it took into account feedback received from participants and stakeholders, the new ACO REACH program is more in line with industry demands than those of physicians, grassroots advocacy groups, and progressive lawmakers. Changing the name doesn't change the fact that the direct contracting program is backdoor privatization of Medicare, Alex Lawson, executive director of Social Security Works, said in a statement, adding, "This dangerous experiment must be stopped before it further harms the health of vulnerable seniors, eats into Medicare Trust Fund, and destroys traditional Medicare." Lawson added DCs and their investors, which include private equity firms, are focused on generating profits. They are incentivized to deny and delay care as much as possible. There are no changes that can address that fundamental flaw at the heart of the program. President Biden must protect older adults and people with disabilities by ending the direct contracting program immediately. Representative Pramila Jayapal, who earlier this month led more than 50 House Democrats in urging Biden to cut off the program, said recently that she will continue to fight tooth and nail against any and all efforts to privatize Medicare. Trump-era direct contracting is a major threat to Medicare coverage hidden in bureaucracy, said Jayapal, the chair of the Congressional Progressive Caucus. While I'm glad to see the administration taking steps to redesign this flood program, I'm disappointed that these changes will not be enacted for 10 months and that there are no limits on how many seniors are funneled into this experimental model. More needs to be done.
Hello, everyone, and welcome back to another episode of The Subcontinent.
The Subcontinent.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of The Subcontinent, where we aim to address the most significant issues in the South Asian region that affect the governments, organizations, the people, and also the region as a whole. So, stay tuned.
In this edition of The Subcontinent, we will discuss the simmering row over the U.S. move to split Afghanistan's foreign assets between families of 9/11 victims. And angry protests in Kashmir over burning of top anti-terror commander General Qasem Soleimani's photo by Indian military personnel.
Afghanistan is an impoverished country teetering at the brink of famine and starvation. The country is desperately in need of foreign aid to stave off a dire humanitarian crisis. People in the crisis-stricken country are tired of decades-long wars, insurgency, foreign intervention and, quote, puppet governments. And with the rampant inflation and businesses in shambles, the Afghan economy is completely falling apart. The country, which heavily depended on foreign aid, has been on the edge since the takeover of Taliban last August. So, what else could disappoint the Afghans?
Afghanistan is a country devastated by decades of war and foreign military occupation. The dire humanitarian situation in the country includes, but is not limited to, hunger, poverty, and a lack of access to life-saving needs. It is while, like other nations, Afghans continue to struggle with the COVID-19 pandemic. Even worse, there are no jobs. A growing number of Afghans, from laborers to university professors, have lost their sources of income and livelihood. Private businesses cannot fund their operations. They have either shut down or laid off their local staff. The case of government organizations is even worse. Foreign aid made up some three-fourths of the budget of the former West-backed government. Following Taliban's sweeping takeover last August, the U.S. and its allies cut off the international aid, and the lack of budget made local organizations virtually defunct. The country's central bank has no access to its own resources to manage the situation. The freezing of assets has spawned what aid organizations describe as the worst humanitarian catastrophe in recent history. While the country's humanitarian and economic crisis continues to worsen, the U.S. administration has displayed utter disdain and lack of apathy, sparking protests in Afghanistan and elsewhere.
On February 11th, the U.S. President Joe Biden issued an executive order to unfreeze $7 billion U.S. dollars of Afghanistan's foreign assets. Half of the fund will be apparently used for humanitarian aid to the Afghan people. However, the Biden administration will keep the other half, which will be used to cover the judgments from lawsuits that the families of the 9/11 victims had filed against the Taliban. This is bad news for the ordinary Afghan people, as they had nothing to do with the 9/11 attacks.
Following the Taliban's seizure of power last year, families of at least 150 victims of the 9/11 attacks staked claim to at least $7 billion in frozen assets held by the Federal Reserves of New York. They claimed that they were awarded the sum by a federal judge in 2012 following a default judgment against the defendants, including the Taliban, Al-Qaeda, and Osama bin Laden. The court required the Biden administration to give its position. This is when Biden's executive order was issued stating that his administration will not object if up to half of Afghans' money is awarded to 9/11 families. It made the Biden administration complicit in the possible transfer of Afghan assets to others at a time when Afghans are staring at a humanitarian crisis. His executive order allocates the second half of the humanitarian aid to Afghans. However, it is likely to take months before the assets are unfrozen and handed over to Afghans. Hence, experts feel it will be helpful in addressing immediate needs of crisis-stricken people in Afghanistan. Biden's executive order was met with outrage within the U.S. and abroad. Many termed it stealing and theft. The U.S. administration was urged to reconsider the decision through open letters, as the reserves belong to the Afghan people, not the U.S. or the Taliban.
For President Biden to take half of our national reserves and assign it or dedicate it to those victims is denying the victimhood of the Afghan people, which is wrong morally as well. Therefore, I strongly disagree with this decision. We want the entirety of the Afghan assets to be kept for Afghanistan. These belong to the future generations of Afghanistan. These are the assurance, the sureties for our monetary policies, for the stability of our currency. Therefore, I disagree with it.
Now we are joined by Dr. Mohammad Dawood Miraki to further discuss Biden's executive orders on Afghans' foreign assets. Now, welcome to the program, Dr. Miraki. Now, what's your take on the U.S.'s decision to return a part of Afghans' own assets in form of humanitarian aid?
The irony is this: what the Biden administration is doing is really a highway robbery, a banditry, international banditry, what they have done. They are basically continuing this revenge mode that has, been going on since their retreat from Afghanistan. And they use the excuse that supposedly victims of 9/11 are entitled to the compensation, when in fact Afghans had nothing to do with 9/11. In fact, Taliban had nothing to do with 9/11. And the assets of Afghanistan do not belong to a political group. It belongs to the people of Afghanistan, irrespective of who occupies the throne in Afghanistan. These assets pertains to the economic stability of Afghanistan, and it contributes to the economic stability in Afghanistan, and it does not belong to any political group. And so what they have done is basically adding insult to injury by, on one hand, stealing Afghanistan's assets and then giving it back to Afghanistan. But be happy, this is charity we are giving you to save your lives. So Afghans are not stupid. They understand, they can see through these mockeries and concoctions clearly.
Dr. Miraki, do you believe the Afghan people are central to the U.S.'s aids?
Well, the issue is this: what they are doing, the aid mechanism that they are following, is classic what they do of how they operate almost everywhere. They use NGOs, their own, organizations, that have relationship to USAID and to UN and whatnot, and a significant portion of that money is allocated to the NGOs, and NGOs take a significant portion of that for administrative costs, salaries, and whatnot. And then, of course, considering the U.S. history of how it operates and what its plans are, we are not going to be surprised that they do not have an ulterior motive, because during the Taliban insurgency, when the Daesh groups were present in eastern Afghanistan, and Taliban operated and attacked them to destroy them and so forth. And when the conflict ensued, the American planes used to come and used to bomb Taliban fighters in order to rescue Daesh and the ISIS elements. And in many places, when the Taliban encircled them and trying to capture them and decimate them, the Americans would come and airlift them, and they would end up taken care of in guest housing in Kabul and other cities. So considering that history, I would not be surprised, because and another thing we need to also understand that Western intelligence agencies, they have strong relationships to various terrorist organizations, and they use these organizations for their foreign policy motives and black ops. And so Afghanistan is no exception to that. But one thing is for sure, they do realize that 48 countries have tried to submit the Afghans, the Pashtuns that fought against them in the Taliban, but they could not defeat them. And I told them in 2002, I told them anybody can enter Afghanistan, but they cannot get out. And when they get out, they do not walk out. They crawl out of Afghanistan. And that is exactly what the United States have done. They have crawled out of Afghanistan.
So how does the U.S. judiciary system find Afghanistan's official foreign assets relevant to the Taliban while it's not recognized by the administration?
There are two sides of the story. First of all, they realize Afghanistan has a strategic location. It's significant, and they also realize that Taliban is a reality. It's not going to go anywhere soon. It is going to stay there, and irrespective of whether the United States or anybody else recognize it or not. But the irony is this: the recognition business is led by the United States, and whatever the United States does, the rest of the world follows. This attempt, that the aid that they sent, that's a public relation ploy as well. Remember, there is a starvation going on in Afghanistan, and the United States tries to play down their role in this nightmare that had continued after their retreat. This was a house of cards in economy, house of cards that collapsed and was an artificial arrangement. And once they retreated from Afghanistan, they realized that that their handiwork is going to be visible to the whole world. In order to cover their tracks and trying to say that they have a humanity, they resort to this type of measure. So we send aid and do this and that. I also like to add, the Afghans that they have airlifted from Afghanistan as a way to indicate to the world that they have concern to the Afghan population, they have a lot of young people that parents send them, because in America it's easy, so they will go there, get educated, and all in all, a lot of these kids, they came here and they're extremely, especially in Chicago, for example, they suffer from extreme depression, and they were telling their sponsors, please send us back to Afghanistan. We don't want America. We want to go back to our parents. But they refused to.
Dr. Meraki, thank you for being on the program. Now, let's take a look at people's reaction to this on social media networks.
Sanjar Sohail is a publisher based in Kabul. He says the Biden administration decision is shameful and disgraceful to both Afghans and Americans. Sabri shares the U.S. forces' pictures with gold bars apparently taken from Iraq. He says, once a thief, always a thief. Mudassir Zawar is a Pakistani student who shares a cartoon of U.S. stealing from Syria, Iraq, and Afghanistan. He calls it the typical American way.
You're listening to the Subcontinent, broadcast by IRIB English Radio. This weekly program reviews ongoing developments in India, Pakistan, and Bangladesh. Listen to the Subcontinent every Monday here on IRIB English Radio.
Less than 2 months ago, people in Kashmir marked the second anniversary of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani's martyrdom with tremendous fervor. But on February 15th, a controversy erupted in central Kashmir's Bukdam district after an Indian military officer was accused of burning a photo of the celebrated anti-terror commander. The incident sparked angry protests in many parts of Kashmir, forcing the military personnel to apologize and reinstall the photos. And the videos and pictures of this went viral on social media.
It all started in Malbuchan village, less than a kilometer away from Magam town in central Budgam district of Kashmir. The Indian forces allegedly entered a residential house to conduct an army census. Eyewitnesses said one of the personnel lifted a portrait of the military commander from the wall and then burnt it. Villagers, boiling with anger, immediately took to the streets. It triggered massive protests in different parts of the Himalayan region. There were also reports of protesters clashing with security forces in the central Budgam district. As protesters upped the ante, the army personnel caved in. Senior military officers visited the place and spoke to the locals. Commanding officer Colonel Rahman was among them. He apologized to angry protesters on behalf of his subordinate. He also raised the photo of Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani and the leader of the Islamic Republic, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, as the crowd were heard and seen chanting slogans. Later, the Indian Army personnel accompanied locals to put up replacement pictures featuring Martyr Qasem Soleimani and Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei in the area. The army urged people to maintain calm. They also issued a statement saying the matter was being investigated while vowing necessary action if required.
Burning the photo of Martyr Soleimani by the Indian army personnel triggered angry protests in Kashmir days after people in the region enthusiastically marked the anniversary of his martyrdom. So what makes him so popular and revered in the Himalayan region? Spending years in the battlefield to defend the Islamic Revolution and sacred Islamic sites against Daesh Takfiri terrorists, as well as the hapless people in the West Asia region, made Martyr Soleimani a prominent figure on the resistance front. In Kashmir, where people swear allegiance to the Islamic Revolution, he has got legions of followers.
Lieutenant General Qasem Soleimani is admired by Muslims across the world. He played a key role in protecting sacred Islamic places in the West Asian region from marauding terrorists. He was ever present on the battlefield, fearless and courageous. He prepared and organized troops for active service, which resulted in the defeat of Daesh Takfiri terrorists. More importantly, he's seen as a hero who stood up for the suppressed people in the entire region. The incident in central Kashmir's Budgam district was not the first time the Kashmiris took to the streets to show their love and respect for the celebrated anti-terror commander. In early January 2020, after his assassination in a US drone strike outside Baghdad airport, tens of thousands of people in Kashmir protested and burned the effigies of the then US President Donald Trump. Ever since, ceremonies to honor his memory have become a regular phenomenon in the Muslim-majority region. Pro-resistance sentiments are popular in Kashmir. People in the disputed region have become more vocal and visible in resisting Indian rule, especially following New Delhi's decision to strip Kashmir of its semi-autonomy in 2019. Many Kashmiris, like freedom-seeking people around the world, adorn the walls of their homes and localities with portraits of the iconic Iranian general, as well as other leaders of resistance.
Now let's join up with Mr. Sajjad Haidar, editor-in-chief at Kashmir Observer, to get more insight on this rare incident in Kashmir. Mr. Haider, how often have you seen Indian forces apologize to Kashmiris, and how significant is this?
Well, thank you for having me. So far as your question is concerned, Indian authorities are, they well understand that the Shia community in Kashmir has been, quote-unquote, declared to be neutral in the conflict so far, and they would not like to mess up with this community so that they also turn against the establishment. So this is their thinking, and this by and large also shows that an understanding to the sentiment, religious sentiment, which they think that these are the symbols of Shia revival, and they should not touch with them. Perhaps that was the reason they came out and tendered an apology.
Sir, from your point of view, what makes General Qasem Soleimani so important to the people of Kashmir?
Well, the General Soleimani emerged as a symbol of resistance across the world for all marginalized people, those who stand up to imperialism and hegemonistic policies of the certain Western powers. So there's no doubt in that it transcends borders, and Kashmir is no exception. But in Kashmir, especially among the Shia community, he holds much, important position, and he's highly revered. And his portraits and across Kashmir all over is a testimony to the fact that he's being loved and he's revered, especially for his role he played against the Daesh and other elements and secured the sacred places in Iraq and Syria.
Mr. Haider, considering this and a like incident, what is your assessment of the developments in this part of the world, and more specifically in Kashmir?
Well, as I already said, these are the symbols of resistance, whether it's Imam Khamenei or General Soleimani. You will see people are donning their pictures in their homes and in the streets in this part of the world. And as I know, in other parts of the world. So the Muslims, especially the Shia community, this has become sort of, symbol wherever they reside. Their habitations are adorned with the pictures of these leaders. And we have witnessed that all along the last several decades, despite the conflict, raging conflict in Kashmir. We never saw Indian authorities or the military, for that matter, intervening in these issues and objecting to these portraits. They are, in fact, you will see them, in places which are very militarily strategically located and very sensitive, in places like Ladakh, bordering China. You will see the portraits of General Soleimani or Hassan Nasrallah or Ayatollah Khamenei there. And military never had an issue with these people because they perhaps understand they are not meant actually to instill element of resistance as much they are to display the revival of Shia, Shia assertion after long subjugation of centuries. Now they see that there are certain leaders who can stand up to the tyranny and, imperialism and all these things, and they happen to be Shia leaders. And this is one thing that the Shia communities, like in places like Kashmir, with their own troubled histories and the issues, they still come out and, display these pictures. And perhaps the Indian authorities also understand that it's not political motive as such. This is perhaps their assertion, as because they have been long subjugated and an underdogs in the Muslim communities.
On that note, I would like to thank Mr. Haider for his precious time and knowledge. Now, this rare incident was widely mentioned on social media networks, so let's review some of them.
Said Zafar Mehdi, a Tehran-based Kashmiri journalist, says an Indian military officer was accused of burning Mata Soleimani's photo in Kashmir, which triggered protests, forcing the army men to apologize and put up his photos again. A senior cleric and pro-freedom leader in Kashmir, Masroor Ansari, asserts that people's sentiments are attached with Imam Khamenei and Mata Soleimani, and desecration of their photos cannot be tolerated. Ahmad Ali Fayyaz, a senior Kashmiri journalist, says military personnel should know that figures like Mata Soleimani and Sayyid Hassan Nasrallah are heroes for Shias across the globe, including Kashmir. Sajjad Kargili, a Kargil-based political activist, hails Mata Soleimani as a symbol of resistance against terrorism, saying people everywhere are indebted to him for defeating Daesh and defending holy shrines. A multimedia journalist and filmmaker from Kashmir, Said Shahriar, shares a beautiful video clip showing Mata Soleimani's poster somewhere in Kashmir on his first anniversary last year.
And that was our episode covering the US decision on Afghanistan's foreign wealth and the honouring of Lieutenant General Soleimani in Kashmir. Take good care.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio programme. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The glorious day of Mab'ath. In the name of God, the All Merciful, the All Compassionate. Salam, everybody, and heartiest congratulations to you all on the advent of the occasion that changed the destiny of the world. Today is that joyous day when over a millennium and four centuries ago, the Archangel Gabriel descended by God's command on Mount Nur on the outskirts of the then obscure town of Mecca in the Arabian Peninsula with the following divine message to a 40-year-old person popularly known as As-Sadiq, or the truthful, and Al-Amin, or the trustworthy. Read in the name of your Lord who created man from a clod. Read, and your Lord is most honorable, who taught to write with the pen, taught man what he knew not. The moment Archangel Gabriel brought these ayahs to the person whose light was the first thing created by God Almighty, calm and confident as ever, as the recipient of the message, he recited these ayahs as if he knew it more perfectly than the conveyor of the message. What transpired on the 27th of the month of Rajab at Cave Hira, exactly 1,455 lunar years ago, was that glorious moment which would change the destiny of the world. This was the start of the gradual revelation for the next 23 years of the Noble Quran, which remains till this day as the immortal miracle of Islam. Please stay with us for a special feature in this regard. It was indeed the dawn of the universal message of Islam. the message of monotheism that was conveyed to the various nations of the world in bits and parts by the previous prophets, whose missions were time-bound and confined to particular geographical areas, was now being entrusted to the one who is undoubtedly the best of creation. It was now the duty of the 40-year-old messenger of mercy to not just expound it to the humanity of his era, but to entrust it to a line of trustees that never veer for a moment from the straight and unwavering path of God. No wonder Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, had said in explicit terms, "I was the prophet, then Adam was still in the uncreated state between water and clay." To doubt the words of the person whose truthfulness the Almighty verifies in the opening ayahs of Surah Najm by saying, "He neither errs nor speaks out of desire, but it is revelation which is revealed," is outright blasphemy. Doesn't God also say in Ayah 107 of Surah Anbiya in the Noble Quran, "We have not sent him but as a mercy to the creation"? As a matter of fact, Mab'ath, which signifies resurgence, is the most important day on which the sun has ever shone. It is the resurgence of not just humanitarian values, but the basic purpose of life and the goal towards which mankind is moving. Hence, it is more significant than the creation of Adam and the start of the human race. It is more memorable than the miraculous transformation into a pleasant garden of the huge fire the tyrant Nimrod had lit up and hurled Prophet Abraham into it. It is more important than the parting of the sea waters for Prophet Moses, peace upon him, to allow him safe passage from the oppression of the Pharaoh. It is more precious than the miraculous virgin birth of Prophet Jesus, peace upon him, without the association of any male for his mother, the virtuous Mary, peace upon her. In other words, Mab'ath is not a spontaneous occurrence in the barren landscape of the Arabian Peninsula. On the contrary, it is the highest watermark in history that separates truth from falsehood, virtue from vices, and right from wrong, for which mankind was being prepared through a long and unbroken chain of divine messengers spanning different eras and various geographical regions in order to build the mindset for the single universal message, Islam. A glance at the state of humanity before and after the proclamation of Islam confirms this point. That is why the pre-Islamic society, not just of Arabia, but also of the supposedly civilized nations of the past, is called Jahiliya, or the Age of Ignorance. Time and space do not allow us to go into details, but even a cursory glance at the cultures of the past reveals that despite their pretensions to power and material achievements, they sorely lacked such basic humanitarian fundamentals as monotheism or faith in the one and only Creator, equality of all human beings without any distinction of color, race, language, and class, social justice as the privilege of each and every individual, including those adhering to other beliefs, women's right to own property, marry according to their will, safeguard their honor and individuality through observing of modesty and hijab that none is entitled to violate, compassion, forgiveness, generosity, truthful speech that are so instrumental in promoting peace and fraternity, refusal to bow to oppression, and last but not the least, rationality that not only negates superstitions, but grants the freedom of education to all, thereby ruling out manipulation of science and knowledge by vested interests. Thus, the marking of Map-Ath means the renewal of allegiance to all such egalitarian principles that make a true Muslim and lead to the building of the real monolithic Islamic Ummah, which Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, preached through practical demonstration, and which the present Muslim world has largely neglected to its own detriment. No doubt, the universal mission of Prophet of Islam was foretold in all heavenly scriptures, ranging from the Book of Abraham to the Torah of Moses and the Evangel of Jesus, as well as in the religious texts of the Zoroastrians, the Hindus, the Buddhists, and other cultures. The skeptics are advised to read the passages in the Book of Deuteronomy, the Gospel of St. John, the Avesta, and the Prunas for confirmation of the universal mission of the last and greatest prophet. This means the 27th of Rajab is the day of formal divine appointment of the mercy to the entire creation. But who was the first and foremost person to bear testimony to the mission of the man who pronounced that fundamental article of monotheistic faith, Ashhadu an la ilaha illallah, which means, I testify there is no God but Allah? The answer is obvious. It was his cousin, ward, and divinely designated heir, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace upon him, who witnessed the glorious event of Rajab 27th on Mount Nur, and who, as a 10-year boy, completed the Kalima, or testimony of faith, that every Muslim recites till this day by saying, Ashhadu anna Muhammadan Rasulullah, which means, I testify Muhammad is the messenger of Allah. In Sermon 191 of the famous book Nahjul Balagha, Imam Ali, peace upon him, informs us, when the revelation descended on the Prophet of Allah, I heard the moan of Satan. I asked, O Prophet of Allah, what is this moan? He replied, this is Satan who has lost all hope of being worshipped. O Ali, you see all that I see and you hear all that I hear, except that you are not a prophet, but you are a vicegerent. That is the reason it is highly recommended to perform the ziyarat of Imam Ali, peace upon him, whether from afar or near his holy shrine in Najaf on the day of Map-Ath. Those still in doubt are advised to go through the contents of the miracle of the Prophet, the fathomless treasure, trove of wisdom, that is the Noble Quran, which confirms in Ayah 43 of Surah Ra'd the position in celestial hierarchy of the person who was considered Quran-e-Natiq, or the living Quran. And those who disbelieve say, you have not been sent as prophet. Say, O Muhammad, Allah is sufficient as a witness between me and you, and he who has knowledge of the book. Economic divide.
The truckers' protests in Canada have subsided for the most part, but it was a costly one, hundreds of millions of dollars lost. But since it disrupted a cross-border shipping route, the bigger question comes about what other supply chain disruptions are taking place. Hi, I'm Kavita Tahvayi, and in this edition of Economic Divide, we will look at the Canada protests, then supply chain disruptions, which are struggling to get back to normal. Coming up in today's programs, Canada rocked by weeks of anti-COVID protests morphing into anti-government protests. The Freedom Convoy protests impacted cross-border trade and has spread to other parts of the world. Next, we're taking a look at the Canada protests and the impact they've had on how it blocked the workflow and transit routes with severe negative impact on supply chains. The chaos at ports, warehouses, and retailers was one of the consequences of that. Then, cheap and reliable shipping, a thing of the past. Lean warehouses and online systems that monitored inventory may need to revert to a more prudent focus on extra capacity or to expand warehouses to cut down delivery time and costs.
Canada has been rocked by weeks of anti-government protests. The Freedom Convoy protests were started by Canadian truckers against COVID-19 restrictions, but they have had a huge negative economic impact on cross-border trade and business between the U.S. and Canada. Protesters blocked the Ambassador Bridge, which connects both countries. It spans 1.5 miles long and carries more than 40,000 commuters, tourists, and truck drivers every day. The protests have hindered, slowed down, and blocked the workflow, with severe negative impact on supply chains. An estimate published by Anderson Economic Group says between February 7 to February 15, the protests caused $144.9 million in direct wage loss.
So we're seeing a blockade at the Ambassador Bridge on the Canadian side, made up of about 30 pickup trucks and one small SUV. And not truckers, people who are anti-government, whose only express demand right now is for the Prime Minister to resign, who have blocked the most important trade link between the two most integrated partners in the G7.
Most of that loss occurred in the U.S. state of Michigan and Ontario province in Canada. Automakers including GM, Ford, Chrysler, Honda, and Toyota lost a total of $155 million. When all factors are considered, it is estimated that the auto industry lost a total of almost $300 million for that two-week time period. The blocked route sees the import of steel, aluminum, and other parts crucial to the Michigan-based auto industry.
About $300 million worth of goods goes over that bridge every day, and now for the second day, nothing is going. In the automotive business, about $100 million worth of parts go, 50 from one side and 50 from the other side. They're part of a just-in-time principle of automotive manufacturing. And so what's happening is because the parts can't make it across or back, all of the automotive production plants in the region, that's Ontario and Michigan, have shut down today. That is about 100,000, 150,000 jobs on either side of the...
About 40% of what crosses the bridge includes automotive parts and equipment and machinery and electrical equipment. Vehicles are Canada's second largest export, with the U.S. buying more than 90% of that supply. The closure of the bridge has affected an estimated $392 million a day in cross-border transactions. It is estimated that $3 billion to $6 billion in goods did not cross the border last week. Trade between Canada and the U.S. is valued to be at more than $700 billion.
The social media posts on this matter were a lot, especially on the truckers' protests in Canada, in which Justin Trudeau became the focus, jeopardizing democracy as opposed to the supply chain crisis. Now here he is giving his explanation on what he has called the truckers' blockade. The ongoing blockades and occupations are illegal. They are a threat to our economy, supply chains, and trade. They're a threat to public safety. And most importantly, they're a threat to communities, businesses, jobs, and people. They need to end. But what became known as the Freedom Convoy protest may have another agenda other than just protests against vaccine mandates. The Freedom Convoy was organized by Tamara Litch, secretary of the relatively new Maverick Party, a right-of-center group that was started to promote the separation of Canada's three western prairie provinces from the rest of the country. Now, she was later arrested, as seen here by Canadian police. This post caught our attention since it points to the reason there is an inflation problem, in which this post says Obama's former economic advisor, Steve Rattner, has said that Biden is wrong to blame the supply chain crisis for inflation. Again, the former economic advisor to the former President Barack Obama in the op-ed in New York Times. It says Biden keeps blaming the supply chain for inflation. That is dishonest. He believes the bulk of our supply problems are the product of an overstimulated economy. He also says that there has also been an unforeseen shift in what people are buying to durables like cars, electronics, and building materials for housing, for which production and distribution capacity is limited. All right, there were some online social media posts. Well, joining us in this segment of our Q&A is Dust James. Dust James is a truck driver from rural North Carolina. He is a member of the Center for Political Innovation, and he's also a host of Anti-Imperialist America, who joins us. Dust James, welcome to the Canada Truck Protest. You're familiar with them. They have hit an economic nerve, obviously, when it comes to Canada in terms of the losses that incurred as a result of it. About $400 million a day in cross-border transactions were lost. How much of a hit did the Canadian economy take from this? And doesn't this show actually a vulnerability when it comes to cross-border trade?
Yes, that's a very good question. I think I would respond with, would you fault a striking fast food worker who refuses to work for less than minimum wage with your inability to purchase a cheap hamburger? And the answer is no. When workers find conditions intolerable, conditions like forced medical procedures to continue their employment, that is not the fault of the worker. That is the fault of those increasingly tyrannical governments with growing police states.
All right, let's find out what Larry Frist thinks. Larry Frist is the adjunct professor of economics at Utah Valley University. He's also a host at Red State Talk Radio, who joins us. Larry Frist, welcome. The Canadian Freedom Convoy protest is the name brought to light the supply chain crisis in some respects. In this case, it was a cross-border trade where is part of the supply chain for that particular industry, which involved automobiles for the most part. Now, much of the focus has been with the supply chain crisis on ports, warehouses, and also retailers. It is set to persist throughout the year. What supply chain links are leading to the chaos, in your opinion?
Hello. So the supply chain issue really is much bigger than this. And let me kind of rehearse part of it. Supply chain issues, with China being the largest manufacturer, begins in China. We don't have real reports, although some reports on the ground indicate that there was a much larger impact of COVID on Chinese manufacturing and factories themselves. As a result, there were shorter shifts. In some cases, there were factories that were closed. And so that meant that production was significantly reduced starting at the point of origin.
Our Infinews section is here where we cover economic news from around the world. Now this time we need to start with something that is happening in one of our neighboring countries. That country is Syria. The economy there is battered and many are barely scraping by, if at all. A Syrian public sector employee said that prices were much cheaper during the war. Her monthly allowance, as she said, 30,000 Syrian pounds, was worth only around $150 at that time, but today it amounts to $6. And while we are on purchasing power, things don't look that rosy for some Western countries also. In this case, France. Seems like up to 80% think purchasing power is decreasing in that country. Mainly, they attribute it to the surging prices of basic goods and energy costs. So obviously there, they are a victim of inflation, as many countries around the world are experiencing the same, hence a decrease in purchasing power. Now, we have covered this topic before. It's about COVID billionaires, but we wanted to revisit it because it just sounds unfair. The rate at which the wealth of the super rich keeps increasing, while the poor at the same time are getting poor. But the middle class, they're the ones that are also getting squeezed. But aside from that, in this case, we looked at the situation in the U.S. Of how the billionaires' wealth increased in the pandemic. You ask, how big an increase did the wealthy experience there? Well, this is it.
99% of humanity is being left behind. So as we've watched billionaire growth double at the rate of $15,000 per second, that's the same $80 less per second than a minimum wage worker makes in a year.
And finally, let's move on to Credit Suisse. Shame on you, Credit Suisse. Why? This investment banking company ignored murders while laundering cocaine cash. Well, that's according to a former employee who said management knew about murders, knew about cocaine smuggling connected to a Bulgarian gang. Hence, it continued managing cash that is now at the center of a criminal trial. If there are any topics that you'd like for us to cover in your part of the world, please let us know. We would definitely look at your recommendations or write to us. If you just want to drop us a line, that's okay also.
Listening to Economic Divide. The series looks at the financial health of the economies around the world and its impact on countries. You can listen to Economic Divide on Mondays and Tuesdays on IRIB English Radio.
When it comes to the supply chain crisis, there are many factors at play that lead to the creation of bottlenecks, and that is what we're going to be looking at in this in-depth section. First, let's take a look at the chain itself because it is noteworthy to see the major access points. Well, it all begins with raw materials. Things like steel, oil, corn, grain, or gasoline. Obviously, an important starting point starts from there. Next up, suppliers. Suppliers are a person or business that provides a product or service to another entity. They provide goods to manufacturers in rather large quantities. Next up, the manufacturer. That's a company that produces finished goods from the raw materials by using various tools, equipment, and processes. Then comes the distributor. In order for that, for the goods to reach the consumer, that is, they play a very important role because it's the only entity that distributes goods in a specific area. After that comes the retailer. The retailer is a business that sells the goods to the public in small quantities for use or consumption. And then finally, people like me and you, the consumer. That's right. Consumer is the one who purchases goods and services for personal use. So wrap up of the parts or the access points we thought were important are listed down here. There were five of them: raw materials, suppliers, manufacturer, distributor, and retailer. Now, when it comes to the supply chain crisis itself, how badly were businesses actually affected? Well, according to this source, we're looking at 94% of Fortune 1000 companies. That's a lot. And to put that into perspective, 75% of supply chains globally were actually affected. Let's put that into context in terms of timing. This graph shows the impact on the time span for the goods to be delivered. We're looking at four different areas: the Eurozone, U.S., China, and the emerging markets. The blue line here is the Eurozone. We can see that is most affected.